from 90.5 WESA, this is The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. For decades, the city of Pittsburgh has had a diversity problem in the makeup of its police force. But after a court-ordered quota hiring system and later a lawsuit, is the city making progress to make the force more reflective of its citizenry?
We've seen a remarkable turn in the number of minority and women candidates. We're still woefully inadequate, and our force does not represent the population that it serves.
And we'll discuss what the acting police chief needs to accomplish to keep his job. Plus, we'll analyze the big news of the year from the governor and the legislature, as well as a visit with the editors of three college papers about their top stories. That's ahead on our weekly news roundup. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. But first, this update. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together, our weekly news roundup. I'm Kevin Gavin. Later in the program, we'll look at the top stories that came out of Harrisburg and how they affected us. But first, according to the Census Bureau, about 25% or so of Pittsburgh residents are African American. The police force, several percentage points below that number. That's according to the Pittsburgh Police Bureau. Diversity has been an issue the city has struggled with for decades in its police force. But is progress now being made? Joining us to talk about that and other issues surrounding public safety, Megan Guza, reporter for the Tribune Review. Megan, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
And Jeff Benzing, reporter covering public safety issues for Public Source. Jeff, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
If you have a question, you can tweet us at WESA Confluence. 1975, a federal court order was issued to improve diversity in the Pittsburgh police force. It was basically hire recruits, bring them on in groups of four. One white male, one white female, one black male, one black female. That lasted for several years until it was actually struck down as unconstitutional. And then in 2012, the ACLU filed a suit over hiring practices. The mayor's office mentioned last week, I believe it was several days ago, that the minority recruiting efforts have been improving and starting to make some headway. As you've covered these issues, are you seeing that? Let's start with Megan.
Well, I mean, any minority recruiting efforts are an improvement. The fact that they're even talking about specifically minority recruiting efforts says something, because that's not something that always came up before. It was always just a, well, that's who applies. So really, any effort at all is an improvement over what it was before. And that's a conversation that they've been having more and more, even just in the past 2 or 3 years.
Right.
There have been a lot of outreach efforts, you know, just specifically targeting minorities, which is something that they didn't necessarily have before. It was kind of a just target recruits.
Sure. It's not just placing an ad, Jeff, or is it? They've been, Megan said, targeted efforts. The mayor talked about things like going to faith-based organizations, mm-hmm. and going to the military, et cetera.
Right, which is a good thing, but that's because it's something that you have to do. You can't just, say, hey, we're hiring, and expect to get what you're really looking for, because there's issues of distrust within minority communities, police officers feeling like they aren't going to be welcomed, feel like they won't belong. So, sure, we do have progress. There's noted progress in the recruiting class. There's also a pretty big decades-long disparity, right? So the Pittsburgh Bureau of Police right now is almost three-quarters white male. White men make up about a third of the city's population. So we're talking not just, we don't have enough black officers. We also don't have equal representation of women, either white or black. There's also a Hispanic population in the city of Pittsburgh. There's also, particularly if you look around the universities, there's a lot of students who are not even American nationals, right? Folks coming in from elsewhere. And we have white men vastly overrepresented in the force.
You mentioned being accepted. Will I be accepted if I'm an African-American within the mostly white police force. But isn't there also the issue of acceptance of an African-American police officer within his or her own community? Because we've even heard repercussions of, oh, you're a traitor to the community if you join them. The mayor told me this is a national issue, a national challenge.
Well, it's an issue of trust, yeah. Right? I mean, are police seen as an outside force who is locking up your kids or harassing your kids or beating up your kids, which is a perception that often people have. Is that fair? You know, you can debate that, but there's that perception. And is enough being done to court the community and say, we are not just here to help, but we are your community. We are representing you and we are keeping you safe.
I think it's kind of a which came first, chicken or the egg type scenario. Between trust of the police by the community and a diverse police force, you know, you have to gain the trust of the community and build that relationship if you want members of that community to, you know, join the police force. But at the same time, if your police force doesn't look like you, then there's going to be, you know, just an inherent element of distrust. And I don't have that answer. I don't know which it is. It's probably hand in hand. You know, with one comes the other.
Maybe individual success stories as they come on. So, for instance, I believe this last batch of recruits to the police academy, there were 28 total, and there was one black female, five black males among the 28, and there was also one Hispanic and one Asian male. Still, the raw numbers, the majority were white males, but at least you're seeing some. So is it going to be sort of that one story at a time, one successful officer having a successful engagement with the community? Is that how it's going to have to happen?
I think to some extent, yes. I mean, this was one of former Chief McClay's, you know, favorite phrases, but change takes time and it's hard. So you're not going to boost those numbers overnight. I mean, the numbers that you just stated are, those are still an improvement. There were, I think in 2006 and 2010, there were recruit classes that didn't have any minorities in them. They were just all white men, mm-hmm. And some white women. So
over a 10-year span, I think from 02 to 12, somewhere in that range, it was like an average of 4% minority. So, I mean, after the somewhat success of that federal court order, then it just died again as far as participation.
Right, right. And, I mean, when we're talking about diversity, there's, you know, there's the issue of, yeah, of course we want diversity. We want it to represent what the community looks like. But one of the main reasons we want that is so that there is actual trust, right? There's people see role models, people who look like them and they've known, they've grown up with. And that's not just so we can sort of go and all, you know, hold hands as a community. It's so that you can do things like effectively solve cases. It's not an issue of no one's going to talk to police if there's a shooting, which is a problem that has existed for many, many years and exists today, despite, you know, all this emphasis that's been put on community policing and recruiting of officers. Those are very real problems that have not been solved. And so we're talking, it's going to take years to have a force that is noticeably more diverse than it is today. Because, I mean, the latest class is like roughly 30% was not white. That's progress, but it's pretty slow progress.
Right. Megan and Jeff, you were talking a little earlier about sort of targeted awareness to try to recruit. And regarding that ACLU suit, the mayor told me earlier this week that it was not just about the numbers of recruits.
It wasn't just that our police force isn't diverse. It was based on the assumption and then proven that we were utilizing techniques to keep the police force from being diverse. That the process of the applicants was weighted against minority and women candidates. And so the first thing we did was end those practices.
So, wow. I mean, It's one thing not to have direct messages to try to make your force more diverse, but direct obstacles? That's another obstacle to overcome when you're trying to build that trust that you two have been talking about.
Right. And that's something that's public. That's out there. These conversations have been had, you know, at high levels, at low levels, it's trickled down. And that's something that I have to imagine just creates another level of distrust. You know, you might have someone looking at the police force who, you know, perhaps a little bit jaded says, well, you know, it's not going to matter anyway because this is already against me.
Right. And I mean, if you're a new recruit, you're coming into a culture that's already established. And obviously there's these efforts to change it, but it's not like all those officers who were sort of involved in that are suddenly gone now. We have, years and years of this culture where it's white guys sticking together. And that's not to say that all those officers are bad or they shouldn't be here or anything. I mean, there's really dedicated officers over that long period of time and a lot of them, but have been through years where the department did not have a good reputation. And that just means that the work that has to be done can't just be a status quo. Okay, we're making a couple steps forward. You have to really, really put attention to it. Otherwise, you aren't undoing harm that could have been done in the past.
We're talking about diversifying the Pittsburgh police force. Our guests are Megan Guza, reporter for the Tribune Review, Jeff Bensing, reporter for Public Source. I think one of the issues is also not just the immediate recruiting to improve the diversity among each recruiting class as they come up, each quarter or every so often, each 6 months, but also looking beyond that and there's also that it just started this fall, this semester. The public safety command, program at West Hales High School. So they're looking beyond the immediate returns.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, that plants the seed of, here's somebody that I looked up to because they were interacting with me in class and a sort of a regular person to person way rather than someone who's, you're walking down the street and you don't know if you should just trust them or if they're going to yell at you or something like that. That sort of establishes those relationships in a way that are in a safe space and can flourish. And you can talk to your friends about how cool this class was and maybe they want to check it out. That's certainly a step in the right direction.
Though also, if they complete that course and once they graduate high school, they'll also wind up with an EMT certificate, which is kind of neat to put them on track. So that's a kind of interesting partnership between Pittsburgh Public Schools and the Pittsburgh Bureau of Police. Megan, you mentioned about one of Cameron McClay's favorite phrases. Well, his successor, at least acting successor, Scott Schubert. It's been about 6 weeks. What have you noticed what he's been trying to do, both whether he's trying to win support in the community or among the rank and file? What have you noticed?
I have to imagine that's a bit of a difficult position, considering kind of the friction, to put it lightly, between former Chief McClay and the rank and file. But he's definitely, when he gave his speech after McClay announced his resignation, he said, we're gonna keep moving forward with these efforts. We're not going to, cut back on building community trust or any of that. And it's, knock on wood, been quiet, at least here in Pittsburgh for the past 6 weeks. But you have seen those efforts from him. One thing that comes to mind was the day that McClay announced his resignation. Some of the community activists got together and had a little press conference outside of headquarters. And Tim Stevens of BPEP said, before they came outside to address the media that Chief Schubert took it upon himself to actively come over and talk to them and, one-on-one rather than addressing the media and the community as a whole and just kind of establish that relationship and say, hey, we're going to keep moving forward. We're going to keep trying to rebuild this trust. So I think doing that right off the bat, it says something.
Mm-hmm. The acting chief was at a community meeting a couple weeks ago over in Larimer. I think Tim Stevens helped organize that, sort of introducing himself to folks and answering questions. And one thing that was notable is he said, okay, all these reforms are going to stay. We're sticking with it. We're going to push them forward. But also that he didn't expect to get any pushback from the rank and file. And that raises a couple questions, right? You sort of think, well, how did the person who preceded him, who brought in all those reforms and got just a tremendous amount of pushback from the very beginning, gonna do that same job even more so and not experience that? And then there's concern within the community. It's like, okay, if the police are not pushing back in terms of rank and file, is leadership looking out for what's best for the community, or just looking at what the officers want themselves?
Right. And, you know, the mayor said that he's got a tough act. He's got to continue to build the trust that Cameron McClay was building within the community, but also he's got to somehow convince the rank and file that if I have to discipline you, it's for the good of the city, and get them to understand that. And that's the challenge. I asked the mayor if it was Schubert's job to lose.
It's his job to win. So he just has to prove that he has the characteristics, the leadership ability, and the skills to be able to carry this out.
So, you know, about a minute remaining. What's he doing to win the job, provided he wants to win the job?
I mean, I think he's trying to show that he's going to stay the course. I don't know how actively he's doing that. I mean, in terms of like speaking out publicly, McClay had a very approachable demeanor. I think the acting chief sort of has to build those relationships now. He seems like he's willing to do that, but actually going out there and doing so that takes a lot of hard work.
Can he build the relationships with the rank and file? And do you have to do it sort of one officer at a time, or do you go to the top of the FOP?
I think it's a little of both. I mean, McClay ruffled feathers pretty much right from the get-go. Just
because he was an outsider, or because of his policies?
Both.
Okay.
And just, you know, isolated incidents, you know, when he ruffled feathers with the photo of him at first night. That type of thing. And I think enough of those incidents built up that it was just kind of an inherent he's against us rather than with us. And Chief Schubert, he's not an outsider, so he has that going for him from the get-go. But it's a fine line to walk, I think, between, you know, staying the course with the programs and showing the community that you're going to stick with this, but also, you know, having the trust of the rank and file.
Megan Goose is reporter for the Tribune Review. Jeff Benzing is reporter for Public Source. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, the top news stories of the year on Pittsburgh College campuses and out of Harrisburg. It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. 2 weeks ago on this program, we focused on the changing media landscape in the wake of the final printing of the Pittsburgh Tribune Review as a daily newspaper. Today on the confluence, we're going to talk with some young journalists who will help shape the media landscape. Kay Burnett is the editor-in-chief of the Duquesne Duke. Welcome, Kay.
Thank you, Kevin.
Elizabeth Lepro is editor-in-chief of the Pitt News. Elizabeth, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
And Josh Krupp is editor-in-chief of Point Park University's The Globe. Josh, welcome.
Thank you very much, Kevin.
Okay. Each of you, who are your readers? Are they mostly students? Let's start with you, Elizabeth. We'll go right down the line.
We write for students, but our readership is made up of people who live in Oakland, Pitt students, and faculty. We have newsstands all throughout the neighborhood, so we do have a lot of residential readers in Oakland.
And Josh?
We at the Point Park Globe really try to tailor towards students and faculty. The faculty love us because we keep them informed on what's going on, and we play the role of watchdogs for the administration. And so we try to keep them honest, and the faculty appreciate that. And alums definitely keep tabs on us. They like commenting on our stories on our website. So really anybody in the Point Park University community.
Okay.
It's kind of a similar answer, but we do have largely student readers, a lot of Duquesne alumni, the faculty, and then interestingly, parents often like to keep tabs on what's going on with their students at their school. So we have a lot of parents who read, especially online.
Well, you mentioned online, Kate. We're going to go the reverse way now. Do you have a sense of how they're accessing the hard copy versus online, the digital copy?
Interestingly, we've actually had an increase in our pickup rates of the physical copy of the Duke over the last year, which is not something that we anticipated. We've been trying to do more interesting covers, more colorful covers, so I think that might play a role in that. But at the same time, we have seen our web presence finally pull even to the number of readers that we have in print.
Josh?
We actually transitioned to a brand new website over the summer. We're able to track our numbers with our new website, and it does very well, but our print edition does just as well, if not better. And like you said, Kaya, our print numbers have gone up, and our web engagement has gone up over the past year, and part of that's because of the new website, and part of the pickup rate, I think, is because with the physical copy of the newspaper, the Point Park community gets all the stories that they need in one copy. If you go to the website, you kind of have to search for it. But in print, everything you need to know for that week is right there. You pick it up. We tell you the 15 stories you need to know. And so I think that's why our print product is still so successful on campus.
Mm-hmm. Elizabeth, are you seeing something similar, different with the Pitt News? And of course, the Pitt News is a daily. The Globe and the Duke are weekly.
Yeah, because we're a daily, we still focus a lot of our efforts on the print edition, and our circulation is near 10,000. We have pretty low online engagement rates, and I've really been working this year to bring them up, so we use a lot of social media. And we've doubled our numbers since last year, but we are still not where we need to be for our online presence. We're still pretty reliant on our print edition.
All right, I have to admit, this is surprising me. Mm-hmm. Your generation still picking up the paper. I found Josh's comment interesting about getting it all. It's handy. It's all there in one publication rather than doing searching. Is that a product of Josh, the website itself, that it's not as easily to find everything there?
Our website, I mean, we have everything that you need to know above the fold, so they say on the website. You get there and you see the four different categories, but I think in a print edition, what you get is that eye-catchy cover that Kay was talking about. You get a nice picture on there, and a lot of times we have a more eye-catching photo, those will do better off newsstands.
Is there a formula, or does it vary from week to week for a weekly newspaper or even day to day for the Pitt News? How do you balance, shall we say, university-related stories versus things that are happening in the city that it will still be interest to our main consumers? We'll start with you, Kay.
Actually, this is an issue that's very near and dear to my heart because this has been one of the focuses of me being news editor last year and editor-in-chief this year is hyper-local coverage. Yes. Local to campus.
Okay.
And I think if we're going to ask ourselves, what can we do better than any other news organization on the planet, it is cover Duquesne News. In that, we are not competing with any other group. We can cover Duquesne University news better than anyone. And this is what our students will come to us for, to be the experts on. So when you ask, you know, what's the balance between broader news and this hyper-local news, my answer would be every story needs to be local in some aspect.
Right. Okay. Now, Josh, again, a weekly, The Globe, same question. How do you make decisions on balance of Pittsburgh coverage with a Point Park angle to it?
It is sometimes difficult to do that, especially because Point Park University really stresses that you're at the intersection of real and world, as they coin it, and Pittsburgh is your campus. And so we're covering our campus, but we're also covering the local downtown community. And if there are stories happening in Market Square, if there's a political rally happening at the convention center, we want to cover it, but we want to tell you why you should worry about that as a student. And we want to get our students' reaction. We want to hear what our professors have to say about that. So I think there's always a local angle, so to speak, and your job as a student journalist is to go out and find that local angle to get your readers engaged and to tell them why they should care.
Okay. Now, Elizabeth, with a larger number of printed copies and Oakland as your area, a very busy place, how do you, with the Pitt News, answer that same question of balance of strictly university-related stories and area-related stories.
You have to figure it out on a case-by-case basis.
Bike lane stories?
Right. We have done many bike lane stories. We did a huge bike lane story last year, which brings in more than just the university community. Of course, you've got people all over the place in Pittsburgh who care a lot about bike lanes. There's a huge biking community. But we also had a professor last year who was hit by a car and killed on her bicycle, and it was a big deal. And so we felt that it was not only necessary to focus on the bike lane story because students wanted it, but also because we had it affect our campus in a really big way. For the election, we wanted to talk to students in the LGBTQ plus community. We talked to students who were immigrants, students who were Muslims. Sometimes we do things that are a little bit more community related than they are student related, but we still mostly focus on what students and alum would care about.
It's The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. We're talking with Elizabeth Lepro, editor-in-chief of the Pitt News, also Joshua Krupp, who's editor-in-chief of Point Park University's The Globe, and Kay Burnett, editor-in-chief of the Duquesne University Duke. So the presidential election was mentioned. Am I going out on a limb and saying it was the biggest national story with a local focus that all of you covered? I'm seeing shaking of heads. Okay. So you knew it was happening. You knew the campaign was coming about. Tell us about how you planned your coverage, what you wanted to accomplish through the campaign with your coverage, what angles you wanted to explore for your readers, primarily the students and faculty. So how did you plan it, and how do you think you executed that coverage? Josh?
For these stories, you have to focus on, I think, the students, because the faculty, they'll go to your Pittsburgh newspapers and they'll get the coverage that they want. But the students want to know how they're being affected by these politicians. And we not only covered the Donald Trumps and the Hillary Clintons and the Bernie Sanders, we also put a heavy emphasis on our local races. We had the attorney general debate held right on our campus in our new Center for Media Innovation. We also had the two Senate candidates debating at KDKA down the street. So we covered that, and we wanted to just play the role that journalists should, and that is to inform the electorate. And we wanted to make sure that students were informed, and we reported unbiasedly what the candidates were saying. And we really stressed a lot in our newsroom to not take sides. And whenever we were editing stories, if there were any hints of bias, we wanted to take that out because we didn't want to be leaning left or right in our news section. So as far as our execution goes, I think we did a very nice job of trying to go down the middle as much as we could to inform our student electorate.
Kay, I noticed in a story about Election Day in the Duke, there was a quote from a young woman. I believe at the time she was the president of the Young College Republicans on Duquesne's campus. And here was a quote in one of the stories. "I'd say that Hillary Clinton is everything wrong with our politics, and Donald Trump is everything wrong with our culture." That quote really stood out to me, and it's really a well-thought-out comment. You could see that she was torn. So is that what you were after in terms of we're going to focus on what the students think, how they're going to react to the candidates as they come through?
It absolutely was. And in fact, we did a follow-up story with that young woman who was the president of the College Republicans. And after the election, she actually resigned her post and said that she's no longer interested in being affiliated with the Republican Party.
But she did vote for Donald Trump, I believe.
She did vote for Donald Trump. Yeah, it's true. So that was how we really tried to focus our coverage, is on those exact stories, trying to find these national trends that were playing out that everyone was following, but find them on our campus. It's definitely interesting. As a college campus, Duquesne is left-leaning in the political beliefs of its students. So we really made an effort to seek out the voices of the minority, which are the conservative and Republicans on campus, while also covering those student groups that would be involved. So LGBT, minority students. That was definitely our focus, but we also made a conscious decision as a news team to go coverage light on the election. Like I said, like the Duke needs to focus on what it can do better than anyone. And while we did try to get those stories, like you saw, we made an effort not to have more than one political story each week and instead focus on things that were going on campus.
All right, Elizabeth, with the Pitt News again being a daily, you need to feed the beast, as they say. You need content, not just to fill up. I don't mean it that way. You have the opportunity, the vehicle, to have a lot of stories.
Yeah.
So could you sort of say, well, we do need to have more election campaign stories?
Yeah, I almost think I'm not sure what we would have put in some sections of the newspaper this year if not for all the political visits. We covered all of them. Every time, you know, Katie McGinty, Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump, Bernie Sanders, I don't think he came around here, but we went to the RNC, we went to the DNC. We did a lot of election coverage, and we had a tab on our website that was updating constantly. We covered on the day of Election Day, we had a live page that we were constantly updating. And then what really was the biggest deal for us was election night when there were a lot of protests in Oakland. We covered it extensively on Twitter. We had a bunch of reporters and photographers out, and that got a lot of pickup. I had a lot of calls the next day about people wanting to know what was going on in Oakland and what the students were doing. And so, and I think in terms of kind of capturing how students were feeling, this is an interesting time because everybody wants to hate on the media for being liberally biased, and especially the college media. We got a lot of, we had some issues with conservatives on our campus, but in the end, of course, we have to get those voices, but you also have to reflect the fact that it is a very liberal place. I mean, it's a college campus. Lots of our students are liberal. Lots of our students did not want Donald Trump to be president. So, you know, on the day after he was elected, we had to decide on a cover. For example, were we going to put Donald Trump on the front, or were we going to put the students who were protesting in the street? And we ended up going with the students because I felt that that better reflected what was going on at the university. So, I don't know. I think sometimes you just have to accept some biases in your readers, not in yourself.
All right. The last question for all of you. And it has to do, I want you to think about the year ahead. What challenges, what opportunities do you have, and how will you address them for your readers? Let's start with Elizabeth this time around.
I think we have a lot of opportunities as young journalists to kind of define the way we want the media to be going forward. And I think we all need to be really realistic about what we're looking at. Like I said, I've made it a big priority to focus on the web, but I'm not going to start groveling for readership. So you're not going to see any clickbait at the Pitt News in the near future.
Josh Krupp.
Keeping an eye on the Pittsburgh Playhouse that's going on downtown. We're expecting tuition to go up again. Our enrollment and endowment numbers were just released, and we're looking into those. And so, and like Liz said, looking into the opportunities just to be young journalists and to cover the stories that happen downtown.
All righty, Josh. And finally, Kay.
We have a new president at Duquesne, President Gormley, so keeping an eye on what his administration is doing, what changes they're making is obviously very important. There are big changes going on in the Uptown neighborhood that Duquesne is situated in, so there's some growth there. We'll definitely be keeping an eye on that. And I think just continuing to improve our online coverage, getting more stories online, avoiding the trap of just putting online, you know, just putting stories online on Thursdays when we publish in print, keeping that online media going, and really just keeping in mind that for a lot of college students, your college newspaper is your first real exposure to print media, to a newspaper. So keeping that in mind and trying to provide our readers with a really good example, this is what good media coverage should look like, and hopefully turn them into newspaper readers for the rest of their lives. That's the goal.
Kay Burnett is editor-in-chief of the Duquesne Duke, Josh Krupp, editor-in-chief of Point Parks The Globe, and Elizabeth Lepro is editor-in-chief of the Pitt News. Thanks to all of you.
Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you very much.
And we look forward to your work in the months ahead and definitely in the years ahead. Coming up, what do you get when you have a Democratic governor and a Republican-controlled legislature? We'll discuss what happened this year in state government when the confluence continues on 90.5 WESA. It's the confluence where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. Things seem to be quieting down in Harrisburg for the holidays, so it's a great time to analyze what our governor and state lawmakers accomplished and maybe even failed to accomplish during 2016. So we're calling upon Karen Langley, Harrisburg Bureau Chief for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Welcome back to the show, Karen.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Katie Myers, the Capitol Bureau Chief for WESA and all public radio stations in the Commonwealth. Welcome, Katie, to you as well.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, let's start with, it always seems like the biggest story of the year because it takes a lot of time, gets a lot of attention, the budget. So Why no stalemate this year after the mess in 2015? What, if anything, changed?
Well, I can say I think obviously the biggest thing was that they didn't want to have another stalemate because approval ratings plummeted for both the governor and the legislature after the first one. So, I mean, there was definitely a concerted effort to put up a bipartisan front to not have these, you know, intractable arguments that they had last year. And one of the things that, you know, had to happen in order to do that, I mean, the GOP was still not budging on broad-based tax increases, which is what something that Wolf has championed since he became governor. So that was not included. And so what you saw this year was a budget that relied very strongly on so-called sin taxes, so things like cigarettes and gambling revenue, those kind of things. And so a lot of it was that, sales-based taxes. A lot of it was one-time funding streams. So you definitely saw more of a mix of where the funding was coming from.
Karen, was it a matter of Governor Wolf also sorting, recognizing the realities of the situation, sizable Republican margins in both chambers?
Sure. You know, the governor advocated strongly for the need to raise broad-based taxes to address the structural budget deficit that we have in Pennsylvania, with required expenses growing faster than the revenue stream. But I do think that that Katie's exactly right, that there just wasn't an appetite after what the state and the capital and the school districts throughout the state went through for 9 months to repeat that again. You know, it's kind of remarkable when you look back over the stories from the first half or the first 7 months of this calendar year, that we did see the conclusion of two state budgets in that time, where usually, you know, you'd be a good 12 months apart in those things concluding. But I think that after, you know, coming so few months after the conclusion of the lengthy impasse, when the legislators and governor were able to find a way to more or less sidestep the fundamental issues of deeply, you know, changing services and state programs or raising taxes, they were happy to push off that fight for another year.
One of the largest components of the budget is education funding. Are we near the levels, say maybe 5 years ago, in terms of total dollars being spent on public education?
We are, actually. And so for context, yeah, so 2011 saw really massive cuts under Governor Tom Corbett, Wolf's predecessor. And so we just had a mid-year budget briefing that the administration gives, and the budget secretary did say that, yes, we're back to approximately the level of funding education was at in 2011. Now, what that also means, and he did note this, was that we've missed out on like 5 or 6 years of growth in education. So the funding is back to, again, pre-cut levels, more or less. I think they cite $640 million as the amount that's been pumped in the last two budgets. But, again, I mean, it was 6 years of low education investment, so, or 5 years, rather. So it's definitely, it's not back to a very healthy place yet.
Karen, as far as the disparity in funding for the poorer school districts, they're still sort of crying out, say, well, that's nice, but trying to improve that their situation. I believe it's only the new money, the increases in spending, that is divvied up in a different way for the poorer school districts?
So that's right. The state approved a funding formula for distributing, as you said, increases in K-12 education funding. And this formula is something that got bipartisan support. The Republicans and Democrats agreed was a good way to distribute increases. But since, you know, we are only talking about whatever small percentage is added on top of existing money, will take some years and some sizable increases in overall funding for that to start evening out any disparities that previously existed.
I want to briefly touch upon alcohol and beer sales reform, if you would. Isn't this traditionally a Republican issue, and yet the governor embraced these reforms as a victory for his administration as well?
Yeah, that's very, very true. I think privatization in any form tends to be a Republican goal. And this bill actually, so the alcohol bill that passed in June was championed by Mike Terzai, who's a prominent Republican. He's the House Speaker. So, or I'm sorry, the Senate Speaker. And
House
so,
Speaker, yeah.
House Speaker, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, anyway, so yes, Wolf did initially oppose this privatization, but he came around, you know, when we saw during the budget, the beginning sessions this summer, he took it on, and it was a change in tone from him.
I have to ask you, since the legislature tasted, pun intended, a little victory in this area, do we expect even more in the future in 17, trying to privatize even more in this area?
We do, yeah, and that's been talked about. Yeah, sorry. That's definitely a direction the GOP has indicated it'll go in.
Karen?
That's right. And, you know, I think that it was definitely a change in tone. Democrats have supported what they call modernization of the existing laws. But, you know, to hear that advocates of a full privatization of sales in the state, you know, they would say that these changes will ultimately lead to the state getting out of the business altogether. And, you know, and I don't think that we're yet going to see Democrats throw up their hands and concede that.
A minute and a half left, folks, and I wanted to get into pension reform. Years and years of discussion. We're still kicking it down the road. Was any progress made? And what do you think of 17? Minute and a half to go. Karen, let's start with you.
Sure. I think that, you know, although it hasn't gotten done yet, I think that the different factions of the Capitol are inching closer towards maybe making some changes for the plans for future state and school workers. We're seeing the governor saying that, you know, he could allow a plan to become law, and Democrats saying that they could, you know, support some changes, although they emphasize that it would need to, you know, protect the workers' benefits, and they do not support some of the recent ones.
Katie, what do you anticipate? Do you anticipate anything with pension reform in 17?
It's definitely going to come up. I think we did see in the most recent attempt this fall to pass a reform. The governor did say that he would consider signing the bill that the legislature, the GOP portion of the legislature, had put forward. The Democrats did not support that. As Karen said, they were concerned about worker protections and whether or not it would amount to real savings. But I think they are in a position where they're talking, and there has been some intimation of compromise. So it's something we'll see again.
Just a couple of words. Other than pension reform, other than, of course, the budget next year in 17, one big issue that might be addressed. Karen.
House Republicans have been talking about possibly doing some kind of structural reforms of government altogether. Not many details yet, but we'll have to see if there is indeed some big change that they're going to be pushing.
All right. And Katie, you get the last word. One big issue that might be tackled in 17.
I think Karen hit it. This budget this year is on track, as we learned this in this mid-year report, to come up at least $600 million short of projected revenues. And so that's on top of the $2 billion, roughly, structural deficit. So we have real financial problems in the state right now. And as she said, the Republicans are hinting at widespread structural changes in order to deal with that.
All right,
so
Katie.
You're going to see a lot of talk about what exactly to do.
Thank you very much. Katie Meyer, Capitol Bureau Chief for WESA. Karen Langley, Harrisburg Bureau Chief for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks very much.
Thanks.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. Jeff Ballew grew up in Homewood. His journalism career began during his undergraduate days at Penn State. He interned at KDK Radio and then television. And now he is news editor with Al Jazeera Media Network. As we all know, there will be a presidential inauguration next month. Jeff Ballew will become the 110th president of the National Press Club, but the first African-American male to hold that position. Jeff joins us by phone from Washington, D.C. Jeff, welcome to the Confluence and congratulations.
Thank you. It's good to be on with Hometown Radio.
Well, you know, we've all heard about the National Press Club, but really, in your role as president and as a whole, what does the National Press Club do?
For more than a century, the National Press Club has been the great convener of the world's leading newsmakers. I think the National Press Club is known worldwide as a great sort of forum for discussion of the key issues of the day. It's also known as one of the oldest and fervent advocates for press freedom when it comes to journalists both near and far who may get stuck under governments who would wish us harm or block access to data that helps people move about and learn and prosper in free societies everywhere.
The president-elect of the United States, not you, is known for his contentious relationship with the press. How do you think this is going to impact coverage of the incoming administration? Is it going to make our jobs different, more challenging? What do you think?
It would seem so. It's no secret that during the campaign that the president-elect made himself an existential threat to press freedom. This is not a personal affront or insult to the president-elect of the United States, but what he says, what he has said, is what he has said. You can't undo that. You can't erase that. Some people like to say, well, there's campaigning and then there's governing. Yes, that is very true. I've covered presidents of the United States here in Washington, and I've watched them shift and pivot into a more calm and reasonable role. But we have not seen in modern times someone so openly combative who has issued all manner of threats to my colleagues and I, to the point where during campaign rallies we have not felt safe. We have had to have ourselves escorted by the police and openly calling colleagues liars and dishonest and everything else but their actual names. And that poisons the atmosphere. And so I think it's incumbent upon the president-elect of the United States to perform a reset and realize we are enshrined in the Constitution. We have a responsibility to do a job, to present questions that are fair but tough, and that he has an obligation as the leader of the free world to answer those questions. And that's what is important in a democratic society.
Jeff, are you concerned, not necessarily as an individual, but maybe as a group of journalists, about access to the president, to the White House?
As a community of colleagues, we've already made that known. And we have issued open letters to the president-elect collectively. We issued a group letter not too many weeks ago on behalf of our colleagues, saying on one hand, yes, we are deeply, deeply concerned, but also extending a bit of an olive branch, saying, hey, we have a chance to make this right. And restricting access is effectively telling the American people you do not want to listen, that you do not want to answer their questions. You do not believe in fundamental fairness. And just because you don't have a high opinion about a particular news organization or a particular reporter, you're the president. You're supposed to be bigger than that. You're supposed to have a thicker skin. You're supposed to rise to a higher level. Do the press conferences and go ahead and do your job and let us do ours and give us the access that we've earned and deserved and are a part of, constitutionally speaking.
Although you work in D.C., you're not forgetting your Pittsburgh roots, your inauguration as president of the National Press Club in January. I understand that it's still going to be a Pittsburgh-themed event. What can you tell us about what's planned?
It's still in the formation, but I have made my theme known to the membership, at least in my initial remarks when I accepted the election results on Friday evening. The Club of Champions, a take on the City of Champions, my hometown. We are known for family and hard work, fair play, great sport, great food, great culture, art. And I'm bringing those values and having them reflected not only into my inaugural on January 14th, but into my leadership style and have that infect the club. When you're in a winning spirit, if you will. We love winners. Pittsburgh exports winners. That's what we do. Not just those who take to the field, but those in our homes. And that's where our values began, and that would permeate everything that we do and how we do in preserving and building a family of colleagues in such a valued institution that has never been needed more than today.
Homewood native Jeff Ballou is news editor with Al Jazeera Media Network, and he will be inaugurated as president of the National Press Club next month. Jeff, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Kevin.
And this reminder, 2 weeks from today, it's our year in review. We'll discuss the most impactful news stories of the year with a panel of six journalists. For this week, that's The Confluence. Our engineer is Tom Hurley. production assistance from Vince Balestrino. The producer of The Confluence is Marcus Charleston. I'm Kevin Gavin. Hope you have a good week of good news.